here. This is bat country.
Hot damn, I never rode in a convertible before.
Is that right? Well, I guess you're about ready then, aren't you?
We're your friends. We're not like the others, man. Really?
No more of that talk, or I'll put the fucking leeches on you, understand? Get in.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Over Under Movies, where we pick one overrated and one underrated movie in the same genre, style, tone of, or however we may see fit. I am Akte Ege Kozak.
I am Eric McClanahan.
And I'm Ryan Oliver.
Yeah, so we have some interesting news for you guys. We've recently switched over to the playlist, and we're really excited about that. And the playlist is also about to switch over to its own website, since IndieWire's acquisition by another company. What's the name of the company, Eric?
Penske Media.
Penske Media. So IndieWire's acquisition by Penske Media, they dropped out all of their blogs. So starting on Monday, the playlist is going to be... You can find the playlist at theplaylist.net. So that's going to be the new website, and we are going to be on it from that point on. So update your bookmarks, and you can keep following us there. And of course, the episodes are going to be posted a couple days after they are posted on the playlist. They're going to be on our regular iTunes feed until we kind of finish phasing things out. So in this episode, which I'm calling Let's Get Fucked Up and Get Lost in the Desert, we are talking about two kind of fever nightmarish films about alcoholism and addiction and people just basically going on these insane journeys.
Substance
abuse movies. Yeah, exactly. That's the more like traditional way of looking at it. So we have these are Ryan's choices, by the way, and Ryan chose the cult 1975. I don't know if it's... I guess it's somewhere between an exploitation movie and a Australian New Age movie. We'll get into that. It's called Wake and Fright, directed by Ted Kotcheff. But before we get to that, we are going to dive into our overrated movie, Ryan's pick for the overrated film, which is Terry Gilliam's 1998 adaptation of Hunter S. Thompson's gonzo journalism quote-unquote masterpiece, considered by some, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So, without further ado, Ryan, why'd you pick Fear and Loathing as your overrated?
This will be very therapeutic for me, because I felt very alone in my circle of friends and, like, my film friends growing up, high school and college and all that, because I am one of the few people I know in my small secular world who doesn't like this movie. And when it came out, I mean, if you go, like to Rotten Tomatoes, it's got a 49% rating by critics.
Yeah, I was gonna
ask you about
that.
Metacritic. It got pretty mixed reviews upon its release, but it's one of those movies that I feel people, especially a certain kind of audience, hold in such high esteem now. Like, they look back on it as a classic movie, even though it got mixed reception, which is exactly...
Plus, there's the Criterion Collection seal of approval as well,
Yes, it does.
That means something.
So does Armageddon, so...
Well, right. Okay,
but
sure.
but it still... It does mean something. You're right. It still means something. And this is what Gilliam wanted, too, when he made this movie. He wanted to make a movie that was... I believe the quote was, "I wanted to be seen as one of the all-time greatest movies and one of the all-time most hated movies." And I guess by that rationale, he has succeeded. But I guess for me, I've always felt this movie, I don't think it's good enough or provocative enough in what it's trying to say to warrant hate, I guess. Like, I don't think this movie should necessarily be hated or loved, and I don't want to, tell people what they should feel about a movie, but I've never really thought this movie had a very particular point of view on the things. Like, it's got a lot of ideas, sure, and it's about this crazy drug-fueled trip that starts at 11 and goes from there, and it's like it's like when you're across the street from a crosswalk and you could see the bus that you need to be on the other side of the street. It takes off and you're still on the other side of the street. And that's kind of how I feel when this movie starts, because it just goes full bore and I've just never really been on board it. And I think, you know, doing my research actually like really helped me unpack a little bit, because, you know, we love movies. We're cinephiles. We love talking about movies. We also love hearing about how things got made and connecting the dots, or you know, coming up with tinfoil hat theories about how a movie got made. And I've always assumed, because this movie was made over at Universal, I always assumed that this was Gilliam's like passion project, that it was his one for him movie he got to make after 12 Monkeys was such a critical and commercial success for him. I think his most successful film commercially anyway. And so I always thought this was his passion project, and come to find out it really wasn't. He was just kind of, I know Scorsese and Oliver Stone tried to get this movie made, you know, since I think like the early 80s, and it never came to fruition, and there was this big like copyright battle and all this like crazy behind the scenes stuff.
It was supposed
and I guess
to be Alex Cox who directed Repo Man, who was supposed to make it, and then he got fired with his writing partner at the last minute, and that's why there's like he gets credited with the screenplay even though he didn't really have anything to do with the final product, because he, you know, went to the WGA and asked for a credit, and there was like this long battle with Gilliam between him and Gilliam. But yeah, like he got fired, and then Gilliam was brought into the project as a hired hand, and basically retooled the screenplay to his sensibilities and just went to work on it. So it really does look like a passion project, because it has all of like these bizarre, weird elements of a Gilliam film. So it was a good choice by the producers and the studio executives, I guess, to like jump on Gilliam as soon as Alex Cox was fired. But yeah, it's a total like hired hand kind of project, just like what was that, The Brothers Grimm or something like that. But it definitely has his, you know, The Brothers Grimm, you watch it and you're just like, yeah, this was a hired hand, whatever, you know, it doesn't have any of his personality in it. But you watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and it's very much like an unhinged, like totally unhinged Terry Gilliam film.
It is, stylistically, sure, but I also feel like watching it, it's not anything that I really haven't seen from him before, and the things that it's trying to say, I mean, there's a fight the system element to it, of course, and you know, all this like bizarre weirdness, as you said, but it's like I saw that weirdness done better in 12 Monkeys, or I've seen that fight the system story he did much better in Brazil.
Yeah.
And I don't feel, because I think he tried to make something to push the envelope of the form, which I respect. It's a crazy ride, like I've already mentioned, but I don't feel that he takes a particular point of view and is able to push it to make the way that, you know, God forbid, and we've talked about this on a previous episode, but God forbid, Natural Born Killers, at least, you know, to me, I don't like that movie. Like, and we've discussed it, and you can go back and listen to it, but like, at least Oliver Stone has a message and a point, and as much as I reject that point in that movie, he still has it, and I feel like that movie, you know, it has that juice to make it both loved and hated, and I understand that. And I guess Fear and Loathing, I think, there are good sequences. I do think that Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro are very committed, and they're really good in this movie, even though I feel like they are good. I gotta give Depp credit, but I also do feel that this was a sign of bad things to come from Depp.
Yeah, because the beginning of the end.
It morphed into his Jack Sparrow performance, which became pretty much everything he's done since Pirates of the Caribbean. But ultimately, like, I think there are good things in it, but I just kept thinking of, you know, better movies. Like for example, I kept thinking, even though it's a movie that just came out not that long ago, and it came out way after this, Inherent Vice came to mind a lot while watching this movie. Yeah. You know,
definitely.
Set in the same year, it has a drug-addled protagonist. Both of them are sort of clinging on to their last bits of the American dream, what they believe is the American dream, which is not so subtly done in this movie, as Ralph Duke has an American flag with him the entire movie as he's like literally clinging on to it. And the Doc Sportello character in Inherent Vice is that way too, but because they are both realizing that the end of the hippie era is
there are a lot of like very on the nose voiceover segments, as if like they made the film without any kind of a thematic through line and just like inserted those voiceovers in there from the book just to basically say like, oh, this is a movie about something. Like it's about, it's not just a, just these two like assholes whacked out of their mind just like going from one random episodic insane encounter after the other. So it feels like kind of crammed in there.
I think what it is it's like one for the fans. Like I feel like this in a weird way that it, Ryan, I didn't know that. Interesting that you brought up that this was sort of a job for hire for Gilliam. I actually didn't know that. Like, it does feel like a passion project, like someone who adores Hunter S. Thompson. But I think mm-hmm. that was really Johnny Depp in this equation.
Yeah.
Because he had this, like, personal Depp. Relationship. Yeah. But, yeah, it's interesting that this is a sort of job for hire for him as a director, yet the film does play, like, isn't it weird that this is a studio movie? You already brought up it's a Universal movie. Mm-hmm. Like that alone is crazy, because the spirit of it is more like 1970s studio filmmaking. So there, I sort of like appreciate it from afar, like that this movie, I can't believe a studio put this movie out right at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that the job for hire thing really sticks in my mind, because Gilliam has sort of fallen into a, like, honestly, I would say I would liken him to Tim Burton with, like, the last decade plus of their movies. Their work is like, it's like they're trying to fit their sort of recognizable auteur style onto a project. I think Tim Burton's more guilty of this because he's made more movies, but, you know, like, put it onto a style that sounds good on paper, but like in practice lately for both these filmmakers, it's just like, is grown really tiresome. And I really don't like their work of late. I feel like Fear and Loathing is the movie. It's that movie where he's kind of been stuck, or he's trapped himself into this style. Like, he's even worked with the same DP on from this movie on and everything on, and it's got the same sort of, you know, extreme, it's like everything from early Gilliam, but just
borderline like fisheye lens on everybody all the time. And it's,
yeah,
it's,
you guys all know what I'm saying, the
like
look of it,
extremely close. Yeah, that kind of like bizarre, like dreamlike, like nightmarish look of like everything is like so close and in your face, and that kind of framing.
It's weird to me, because 12 Monkeys is one of my, at least for me, one of my favorite Gilliam movies, and yet it's very mainstream. It might be the most,
it's the one where he found that perfect balance between mainstream and his own specific style, and it's
right.
It's like such a great mystery science hard sci-fi story to watch, but then it also has his like bizarre, you know, visual touches.
Right. Well, and it's also a great remake of another great film, La Jetée, the Chris Marker film.
That's how you make a remake. You just take the main core of the premise and just build expand it out
from there.
Do your own thing from there. So it's like, it's a really good example of a remake as well.
Totally. And I wish he would have, maybe he felt constrained. I don't know enough. I mean, I appreciate Gilliam, you know, and love some of his films, but maybe I just don't know. I know he has had issues on like every production, and usually it's with studio people or whatever. But I just wonder like why, I wish he would have taken more lessons from the 12 Monkeys Gilliam filmmaking than he did from Fear and Loathing. But you look at everything since, and Brothers Grimm is kind of a nightmare. And like, then he did Tideland, which is just this hateful, horrible. Oof. And I have just not liked anything since, even stuff that you want to get behind, like Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, but like, it was not good. And like this, the last one, Zero Theorem, it's sad to me, because it's like, he's one of these filmmakers that has sort of regressed or I don't like his movies anymore, but Fear and Loathing, while being the best example of this like trap of style he's been in, is kind of a sad fact that that's the best example, because
I think it's the beginning of his downfall. It still has some of I don't want to say charm, but some of like the manic energy and the qualities of his previous work, while starting to look like, okay, he looks like maybe he's getting a little bit tired. He's stuck in this rut and he doesn't know how to get out of it. And yeah, it looks like, stylistically, it looks like a passion project, but at the same time, you can kind of tell that it was like a hired hand kind of thing, because it's very episodic, and in a way that just, you know, to me this movie, I have like a love-hate relationship with it, and more hate than love in a lot of ways. Like, I really appreciate that the idea that, you know, what you brought up, Eric, that this is like a this, how insane this, and how manic this movie is, and how it's on like it's on 11 from minute one to the last second, and how this movie could have been even released by a studio. But just like we talked about with the Observe and Report episode, just because like an uncharacteristically dark and weird movie got released by a studio, it doesn't automatically, you know, it's, you appreciate it, but it doesn't automatically make it good, for, you know, it's still subjective in that way.
And by the way, guys, real quick, this was a summer release in the when it came out.
It's crazy.
Yeah, sorry, man. Anyway.
So I appreciate all this. I appreciate like the dedication to this insanity from pretty much everybody involved, including Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro specifically. But at the same time, it's just like, it's the problem is that it feels to me, and has always felt to me that way from the first time I watched it when it first came out. This was a movie that I knew that it was kind of bad news when it's a major release starring Johnny Depp that didn't get released in Turkey, didn't get any kind of a release. I had to like basically borrow it from my film theory teacher at the time and watch it that way, because it didn't get any, it wasn't shown on TV, it didn't come out on home video or anything like that. So that was kind of like really bizarre. But I was like on a Gilliam high at that point. I really loved 12 Monkeys. I loved, you know, Brazil was like one of my favorite movies at the time. So I was just like I was just like determined to track it down. And I watched it and I was just like, the underwhelming part of it is, I think, is because it feels like an entire movie made up of a series of deleted scenes.
Yeah, I
don't know if you guys like get this. You know, like the deleted scenes on a DVD, you know, special features, you go in and then you, like, it's almost like you, there's another movie somewhere that's like, that has a structure, that has some kind, that has highs and lows, that has a certain kind of rhythm. And then this movie that we're watching, it's almost like you go into the special features menu of a Blu-ray and you hit play all on all the deleted scenes, and this is what you get. So that's
a good description. And there's, do you want to hear the meta line within the movie that pretty much describes exactly what you're saying? Yeah. Exactly how it feels. It's when Raoul Duke goes to interview the guy at the Mint 400 race, and they're out and the guy's driving, and he looks back at Raoul Duke and he says, "I'm going to try all different kinds of lenses and films until I find something that works in this dust." Yeah. And that's the movie. That's the movie.
Right? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's looking for, you know, whatever, throwing everything at the wall and hoping it sticks.
By the way, MVP, Craig Bierko in that role is hilarious, I think.
As the photographer?
Yeah. He's really funny.
There are a lot of good cameos in this movie, for sure. Like, for sure.
Yeah, but especially, like, I was super, I was mostly bored watching this movie. And I'll give you an example of how bored I was, like, you know, speaking of cameos. Christopher Maloney shows up in this movie as a openly gay concierge at the Flamingo Hotel, and he's taking crap from like an older, you know, couple and saying like you know, derogatory cop, homophobic language too. Yeah, like a bigoted cop. And I sat here and I'm sitting there and I'm going, wouldn't it be funny if that was actually his same character from Wet Hot American Summer, but before he went to Vietnam? And so like, and then they like pardoned him like Full Metal Jacket style, and that's why he comes back like so sexually confused and like humps the fridge and Wet Hot American Summer. Like, that's the kind of shit that's going through my head watching this movie, because I couldn't,
you'll just go on tangents.
Exactly. And you know, to complete my thought we got off of about inherent bias, the only thing I wanted to say is like the Doc character in that movie is similar, except that's only a texture of his character and it in a bigger entertaining detective story. And all this movie is about is like the lost American dream that's coming to an end for this, the Hunter S. Thompson proxy in the movie.
But if you take out all of those, you know, you get the symbolism of the American flag and like it's all in your face, of course, and the kind of culture clash between the kind of like right wing silent majority Nixon people and the hip and cool drugged out like kind of gonzo people that Huntress Thompson is just like kind of in between and trying to like mediate these two worlds, because he's also like kind of like a pro gun like a gun nut psycho, and then in many ways like he had some qualities that were like very right wing as well. And but if you take out all of those like the voiceovers that I'm talking about that seem kind of like crammed in there to give the film some kind of subtext, it's basically about two assholes just wreaking havoc in Las
Vegas. It's The Hangover, dude.
It's basically, yeah, I mean, it's like an art house version of The Hangover, and it's just like,
it's a,
no matter how much like meaning you try to like pump in there, I feel like I never really, really get into it. Like, I just get into the manic energy of it, which is exhausting after a while. Like, I really love the, from the first time I watched this movie, I've seen it like, I think 3-4 times already, and I feel like every time I watch it, before I watch it, I get a little bit excited because I'm just like, oh, it's going to be, you know, I just get excited for like that kind of like go for broke manic energy that the film has. And I feel like it's just going to like take me on a ride with it. And every single time I forget how exhausting this movie really is, because the first time I watched it, and this happens to me pretty much every time I watch it, it's like the first 10 minutes, like in the desert, where it's just like the intense, like, fast voiceover and the inner monologue mixed with, like, what they're talking and the sound design and the incredibly close, weird angles. And you get in there and you're just like, oh my god, this is, like, this is so, like, the manic energy, the insanity of Johnny Depp's performance and how crazy everything is. And then that scene ends and then you start realizing that, wait a minute, the rest of the movie is going to be exactly like this.
Yeah,
like it's gonna be you're in this for another 2 hours. Like, it's not like, like, and then that kind of dread sets in every time I watch this movie, and I'm just like, and I've never been able to watch this movie from beginning to end in one sitting. It almost takes me like at least like this time around, it took me 3 attempts over 2 days to get through it, because it's like you run out of gas after about 20-25 minutes of the same thing. It would have been interesting, and the underrated movie that we're going to talk about does an excellent job of basically of the build up towards insanity. Totally. But this is a movie that starts at 11 and ends at 11. It starts at insane, goes through the same flatline levels of insanity and ends, and that's just as, to me, that becomes just as boring as a movie that just like it starts in the middle and ends in the middle. You know, it's just like you still have a flatline. It doesn't matter where the line is. It might be at 11-12, like you're just like cranking it up, but at the same, after a while, you're just gonna get overwhelmed. You're gonna be exhausted. You're gonna be like, okay, I'm just gonna shut this shit off now. And that's what happens to me every time I watch this. I mean, I really appreciate
it's monotonous. Yeah.
It is. It's monotonous and episodic, and you know, it's like, that's how I feel. Like, I really love the energy of it, but yeah, it does represent to me like the beginning of the end for like quality Gilliam films. So it's a bit of a like double-edged sword in that sense, I guess.
It's kind of like the things that make this like a good drug movie, where I can see why some people really, there is a cult to this movie, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, is also what makes it exhausting, because it's such a relentless attempt to just capture one of the most insane binges ever captured, you know. And because it's so true to the text and wants to, and in a way I respect it for being like true to its source, it also gets you into the problem where it's like, now we look at it and it's like, yeah, these guys are just assholes. Like, Hunter S. Thompson is a hero in some ways, like a great writer. He created a whole form of journalism that's super exciting, but it's also like the characters in the story we're watching, they're assholes. So like, it's this weird thing where, because it is so close to the source, that there's not enough of like a, it took so long for this movie to be get made from the source, that it's like, I don't know, you almost, it doesn't feel like there's an, I mean, it's like, it's that weird thing, it's that push and pull.
And it started with like Jack Nicholson was supposed to be, right, like, that's how far back it goes,
right, the list of people, it was going to be like him and Marlon Brando, I heard, weren't going to be in it.
It was at like, one point it was going to be John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. I would have killed to see that.
That would have been interesting. Yeah, exactly. So it took so long for this thing to come to fruition. It's like, it's like both, I respect it for staying true. It's honestly, this is a movie that hasn't really come out yet, but it's a similar issue I have with Ben Wheatley's new movie, High Rise. From what I understand, it's very accurate to the text that it's adapted from, but like, it also doesn't necessarily work as a movie for me in the same reasons, where it's like, well, whether you're familiar with it or not, like, it's not a great movie. It's just, maybe it's just a really faithful adaptation, and that's enough for some people. But in this case, this movie's just relentless and gets exhausting after a while.
We'll have to revisit High Rise after I see it this weekend and talk about that. But But I'm glad you brought up the, you know, the drug movie angle that people seem to like really latch onto about this being like a crazy drug movie, because whenever I've said that I don't like this movie, almost every response I've gotten back, people sound like Jon Stewart from Half Baked. They're like, you ever seen a back of a $20 bill on weed? Like, everyone says, like, you have to, if I say I don't
you
like
see a moonlight movie, on weed?
On weed, they're like, you either have to watch it high. I've also been told by somebody it makes more sense high, and I was like, well, yeah, so does The Room.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean that it's a good movie. Right. And like, to me, that's a terrible argument to say if something has to be viewed high for it to either make sense or be good, then it's not a good movie. Like, you,
yes,
Eric,
exactly.
You wrote this great piece at Oregon Art Watch recently about your screening of Baraka in 70mm, and you talked about how it might be the most perfect weed movie, but you also capped that article off by saying this is a great movie,
regardless.
Stoned or sober.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, a great movie is going to function on both levels. And so for someone to say that this movie only works high, it's a shitty argument. Like, it's a bad argument, and it makes me feel better about my position on this movie, because I think deep down, like, especially early, like, you know, when you're studying film, and like, there's a lot of ego, and there's a lot of pretension from people, and it's like, you don't want to, like, you're deeply insecure, and you don't want to sound dumb about something at first, and so you're like, I'm like, I'm missing something. I must be missing something about this movie that everyone seems to be, you know, raving about. And
it's,
now
it's okay that you're in a safe place.
Yeah, well, I know I'm in a safe place, and I'm at that point in my life where I'm, you know, I'm confident with the knowledge that I know and the things that I know what I'm talking about, to where I'm like, I just don't like this movie, and that's fine, and that's yeah, fine that exactly. People do. It's just to me, it's, you know, it's got all those ideas, like you said, it's got voiceover, you know, shoehorning it in to give it meaning, but you know, it's just all about the crazy ride of a drug binge. And you're really on board it, and you're not. And I just am not. Whereas our underrated movie, like, totally am 100% on board with that.
Yeah.
That might be a good spot to, like, start switching. I think so.
Unless you guys have anything to say, to close the chapter on Fear and Loathing.
Yeah. So I want to just quickly just go into a little bit more about what it could have been, and about like what Eric said about it being really loyal to the text, and how a lot of people around that, you know, after the film came out and the talks of a movie adaptation were going around, and a lot of people were saying, like, you know, this is kind of impossible to adapt into a film, because this is exactly what's going to happen. It's just going to start crazy and be crazy and end crazy. There's not going to be any highs and lows, and it's just going to be exhausting, and that's exactly what happened. What could have been interesting is if you guys all know who Ralph Bakshi is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, the animator.
Animator, Fritz the Cat, American Pop.
Wizards,
Lord of the Rings, the animated movie. So he wanted to make an animated version of it, and he was determined, and I'm 100% on his side, he was determined that the only way you could adapt this material was a cartoon. And he wanted to make the cartoon in the Ralph Steadman drawing style. Like, you have to basically bring those, you know, there's the Fear and Loathing book has these, like, really bizarre, like, very exaggerated drawings by Ralph Steadman.
They're great,
yeah, and he wanted to just basically take those drawings and animate them, and like just basically bring them to life and make that movie that way, and he thought that was the only way, and he thought that, and, you know, of course, Hunter S. Thompson being an insane person, he gave the rights to a girl who was like some girl that was like his girlfriend at the time, and the girlfriend was just like, no, I want Johnny Depp in this movie. Ralph Bakshi's like last words on the matter were basically like, look, if you make this a live action thing, it's just going to end up being this annoying live action cartoon. And then apparently he went and saw the movie when it came out, and he was just like, yep, that's exactly what I said it would be.
Yeah, that's so on point, man.
I think that would have been cool. So there was, I feel like, yes, maybe it is unfilmable in a way, but I feel like a cartoon in that kind of like really exaggerated raw style of the drawings could have been mm-hmm. interesting, maybe at like an hour and 15 minutes or so, just like get in and out.
Right.
Because it would still start off at like a top setting of insanity and end that way, but you know, you watch like Fritz the Cat and all that stuff, and it's like, mm-hmm. It's, they are at, you know, Ralph Ralph Bakshi is like an episodic kind of animated filmmaker, and he does like, you know, dabble in that kind of style. So that could have been, I feel like that could have been really cool. But what we get here is kind of a mess.
You also bring up another good point, is that, yeah, this movie's just too long, even at 2 hours. It's just, yes, it's just too long. And if I have one final thing, it's like actually a bit of appreciation, but still, Benicio del Toro is like one of my favorites. I adore him. He's one of my favorite actors, and even he can't like save this movie, if not that it needs saving. He's great in it, and I think he's better than Depp, and I actually think Johnny Depp is pretty awesome in this movie. It's just, it is a sort of early sign of what's to come in a much worse form, much like what's going on with Gilliam and Tim Burton as a filmmaker as well. But in hindsight, Gilliam. Yeah. So yeah
it's just, in hindsight, his performance is a lot more annoying now because of like when it first came out, we didn't know what it was going to lead to, and right, now we know. And now I watch it, I'm just like, ugh, like
Wonka.
Shades of like Willy Wonka and
Mad Hatter and
Jack Sparrow,
you know,
and all
just bad stuff. But yeah, I give you Del Toro, man. So he's Del Toro committed, and he put on a shitload of weight for this movie.
He gained like 50 pounds in like 8 weeks or some crazy thing. He has a good story. I think it was on the Mark Maron podcast when he was on there, or that, or Fresh Air. But he talks about how he just like ate the diet he ate. Like, he said he essentially had like a great time eating the food he ate, but you know, it's like not good for him. But yeah, no, I love it. He's committed, but also not like a bullshit phony method. Like, he doesn't do that for show. He's just like, I don't know, Del Toro's the best, but he can't save this movie. It's pretty tiresome. So yeah,
no great performance.
Too weird to live, much too rare to die.
Yeah.
Nice. Perfect.
Exactly. So are we ready to move on to our underrated pick?
Let's go to the Yabba.
Let's go to the Yabba. All right. I can't do an Australian accent. So our underrated movie, Ryan's underrated pick, is another Let's Get Fucked Up and Get Lost in the Desert movie. This one, I would say, you know, every once in a while there are one of those movies where everybody says how amazing it is, and then you kind of like put it off for no reason whatsoever, and then you finally watch it and realize how great it is, and then you feel like an asshole for putting it off for so long.
For waiting.
So yeah, this is one of those for me. So it is 1971's Wake and Fright, directed by Ted Kotcheff, the proud director of the only reasonable Rambo movie, First Blood, and also recent director of a bunch of Law and Order Special Victims Unit episodes.
Oh, nice! He's still working. Nice.
Yeah, he's still doing a lot of TV stuff. And I actually like had a meeting with him, so I'll get into that if you guys want a little bit. Yeah, I had a big meeting with him in L.A. It was so big. It was like between his like lunch and whatever, like it was just like a 5 minute thing, but yeah, I can get into that. But yeah, it is Wake and Fright, 1971, about starring the great Donald Pleasance, and the main guy's name is Gary Bond, who plays John Grant, a school teacher stuck in the middle of nowhere and trying to like basically make time pass by getting shit-faced, and he needs to go to Sydney to see his girlfriend, but gets stuck in this like this mining town from hell is the easiest. Like, it's this place is like a living nightmare, basically full of alcoholics and weirdos. For him, at least, yeah. But yeah, and he gets stuck in there, and things become. He just basically slowly starts losing his mind through the lovely help of alcohol.
Why did you say that?
Say what?
About them being proud of hell.
Discontent is a luxury of the well-to-do. You gotta live here, and you might as well like it. Why don't you like Crawford?
Joe?
The touch of his hairy hand, Benjamin.
I'm a fool with the aggressive hospitality, the arrogance of stupid people who insist you should be as stupid as they are.
It's death to farm out here. It's worse than death in the mines. You want them to sing opera as well?
And what do you do?
I drink.
Ryan, I think this is kind of an obvious question, but why did you pick Wake and Fright as your underrated?
Well, even though this movie has a lot of critical acclaim, more so, way more so than Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it was lost for a very long time after it came out in 1971. It was sort of like one of those lost, hidden gems, you know, by legend, one of Australia's best films. You know, people put it up there with Mad Max and Walkabout, but it was never... You could never find the movie anywhere until 2012, I believe. Drafthouse Films unearthed it, or somebody was able to restore a print of it, and Drafthouse Films picked it up and redistributed it.
Was it the DP or the editor who was trying to track it down, and he found the negative in somewhere in the Midwest, where it was going to be destroyed, and then he saved it and restored it. Basically, that was like
nice. Yep, it was the editor, Anthony Buckley, the film editor, found it in Pittsburgh. Yeah, and it was like you said, it was going to be destroyed, and you know they were able to restore the film from that print, and that was the DCP. I unfortunately did not see in the theater, but I believe Eric did. Yes. Saw a DCP of it, and then you know which Drafthouse Films later released on a DVD and Blu-ray. I have the DVD and it looks pretty great. So this movie, even though it's got acclaim, even though Drafthouse Films, which is you know a great distribution company, and they you know cater to people like us, but they do preach the converted a little bit, and I feel like this movie, you know, even outside the circle of people who are already ready to embrace it, not a lot of people have heard of it, not a lot of people have seen it. I could also see when the movie is on Netflix, the poster that they used for the re-release is him with a gun, you know, kind of wandering, and you might think that it's going to be like a revenge movie, like a Death Wish.
Yeah, it's like an exploitation.
You think that it's going to be like the Australian version of Death Wish, and it's not that at all. And I could see where someone might be misled, but I think the film that Ted Ketchoff made is fucking great. I absolutely love this movie. I actually have seen it twice in the last 2 weeks. I watched it before picking it as an underrated movie because I hadn't seen it in a while, and then I loved it so much that I just rewatched it two nights ago in preparation for this podcast. And Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas to me is a visual movie, but it's not a visceral movie. Like, I'm never sucked into it, whereas like this is an absolute visceral movie with an actual character, like you know, not a caricature but an actual character that you sit here and you agonize over the nightmare that he's having and the hell that he is going through, but you also understand and you see a lot of yourself in this performance. And I think that is off-putting for some people because people don't want to be in that headspace and they don't want to think about that. But and I guess the other thing, you know, comparing this with Fear and Loathing, you know, I've never been on the type of drugs that makes you imagine the shit that Hunter S. Thompson did in that movie. Right. So maybe I just can't relate. But like,
you haven't seen lizards in a bar?
No. But I've been blackout drunk, and I'm sure all three of us here have been at some point.
Yes.
And this movie, there's one scene that like completely captures the feeling of being blackout drunk. It's just the way that the camera is spinning and the way it cuts to black and then cuts to a snippet of an image and then cuts to black and then cuts to a snippet of an image. It's yes. fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I also think that like this movie, you know, you get the feeling at the end of Fear and Loathing that Hunter S. Thompson, or Raoul Duke anyway, like he's fine. He's driving back to California. He's going to be okay. We don't see that in John Grant in this movie. Like the ending to me is like, it's weird that he, you know, he's trying to see his girlfriend in Sydney, yeah. as you mentioned. But you never get the sense that, you never really get the sense that he either wants to make it there or she even knows he's coming. Because at one point,
yeah, he doesn't try to get in touch with her, or she doesn't try to call him, or you don't.
Well, he was asked to because he loses all his money gambling, and the person who kind of takes him in asks, like, is there anybody you could call in Sydney? And he's like, no, there's nobody I can call. But it's like, you know, if you could call her, but
or does she even exist,
there's got to be something. does she even exist is a question. Are they estranged, you know, because it's like he's this college graduate, but not of privilege, who wanted to become a teacher, and the only job that he could find is in this little podunk town of Tabunda that apparently only has two buildings, a school and a bar slash hotel.
And he's stuck because like, he has like a deposit to the government. And the reason he actually loses all this money to gambling is because he gets greedy, because he thinks he makes like a bunch of money, but then he's just like, if I do like double or nothing, then I can like get out of my contract and leave this like shitty school teaching job, and that's what like does him in, basically.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But and it just doesn't work out for him, and you just feel like, you know, I know a lot of podcasts have talked about Green Room lately, because that movie's out, and you know, talking about Jeremy Saulnier's previous film Blue Ruin, of that it's just the cycle that's going to keep going for this character. Mm-hmm. Like it's never going to end for him.
Yeah, the very ending basically makes it clear that like no lessons have been learned, and that's basically the cycle of the alcoholic in many ways.
It is, and it's a dark ending, but this movie, despite how fatalistic it is, it's fucking entertaining.
So like, agreed.
From beginning to end, it's so entertaining. There's entertaining performances, and we have to talk about Donald Pleasance in this movie, who's just incredible. But before we get to that, I've talked a lot. I want to know what you guys think of this movie, and I'm pretty sure I already know, but you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so Eric, chug your pint and dive in, man.
I already finished it. That Ryan did a great job of talking about how a specific sequence, I think you're talking about where they represent like that, what it's like to black out, like at least the moments you remember when that happens is when they're partying at that guy's house. Ryan, is that the sequence you're referring to?
Okay. Yep. Yeah, they're like decorating a Christmas tree and
with the tabs from all the fucking beer cans they've been drinking. And that's the way time progresses in these moments of time. It's like this movie does a lot of things very well. That's one of them. Another thing that this movie sort of overall gets at to me that I love, that it, I think it does better than any other movie, honestly, that I've ever seen, is this movie nails the feeling of what it's like to be partying with people that are just on a whole other level than you will ever be, where it's like you realize you are outmanned, outgunned. Like these people like to party way more harder than you. And I think that's only one element of this movie, but it's kind of the one I love because there are these other sequences too during these binge drinking, you know, which is most of the narrative while he's stuck in the Yabba is, for instance, there's this really horrific and real, that's why it's horrific, kangaroo like hunt that actually happened, and they filmed it, and it's while these guys are just partying and just killing everything, it's just laying waste to the land, but then they go back to the bar again, like at the end of the night, they've already been out twice, like driving around, you know, drinking and killing kangaroos. They go back to this bar, and it is, I think, and these are big words, but I think this is one of the best, like, drug, whatever you want to call it, substance abuse movies, because this sequence nails where they're these two brutish kind of local guys and Donald Pleasance just start basically fighting and destroying this whole porch of this bar. Like, Donald Pleasance is like, yelling in a way, and you guys know the sequence I'm talking about,
it becomes
about,
guttural, it becomes like animalistic, they turn into animals basically,
and it's okay, yes it is, and that's why I actually think it's hilarious. I think it's one of the funniest scenes in a movie about this, but yet this movie straddles this line the entire time. Like, it's like a movie that it's fun that you bring up Green Room in a way, Ryan, because it's a fellow movie where like the shit hits the fan for very different reasons, but Wake and Fright is another movie where like the shit just hits the fan at a certain point and you're watching just unrelenting like douchebaggery, but in a way that's actually entertaining, because we're never led to believe that these are heroes of a story, mm-hmm. which is ultimately a problem I have with a lot of like drug and party movies, like the aforementioned Hangover or even Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, is you're supposed to kind of be on board with those guys in some way. But what I love about Wake and Fright is it has the artistic sense, the strong sensibility to know that these guys are not really heroes, but they're the people you're going to watch nonetheless, because they're fucking entertaining. But like, it's entertaining, it's funny, but yet the spiral they go in is just so like depressingly fully realized. And I adore this movie too. I would say that we do a pretty good job, I'd say, so far in the existence of this podcast, of championing like 1970s gems, not just mm-hmm. American made movies, but it's definitely a thing. We've all chosen movies like this, like Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia and The Friends of Eddie Coyle, stuff like that. Like, this is just another one. And this is honestly, the more I watch Wake and Fright, I really think this is like one of the great, great movies. I really love it. So I will
too, and it toes that line even further from that scene between the comic and the tragic, like you were talking about, because that scene is hilarious, but then it's like it goes one step further, and like, yep. You're like, did they bang? Like,
then
you go back to the house, and like, and is,
we should talk about
it. but it's totally you know, definitely
the way they relate to each other in the morning, and the awkwardness of it is a little bit like suspect.
I think they do.
Weird.
Yeah. I think
you're talking about or Donald Pleasance maybe rapes him or something. Like the way that they're.
I think they got fucked up and fooled around, man. And that's why there's this awkward homoerotic tension between them at the end of the movie. Like,
yes.
I really think, and that just adds another level of like, it's not like it's saying that like, oh my God.
It's not sensationalist about it. It's not like, oh, look at these guys.
Well, like, fucked, okay. Man. Right, when the movie Shame came out, the Michael Fassbender, Steve mm-hmm. McQueen directed yeah. movie, there's a sequence where some people were offended, I remember, because there's a point where it's like kind of portraying him hitting bottom as a sex addict, and one of the sequences in that is that like he goes to a gay club and just pays a guy to like, you know, to blow him.
Off, yeah.
But I don't, you know, it's all how you read it, but like the point I'm making is that it's like in Wake and Fright, I just think it's not making it like sensational, like, oh my God, these two guys like fooled around and how terrible, like, look how the movie's not saying like, look how low he went. It's just like, it's just another crazy thing that happened, and then that's why I think it's sort of matter of fact and also ambiguous the way they play with it. But it's like another element of like, just look at it's more of like the arc that he goes on. It doesn't have to necessarily teach a lesson or make a point. It's just like, you watched a fucking movie when you watch Wake and Fright. Like, you saw an arc in a character.
Well, there's actual ups and downs, and there's an arc, there's a progression, oh my God, yeah. There's a structure, all of such these things that are missing from Fear and Loathing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wake and Fright is the rare drinking, rare getting fucked up movie where there is a really strong structure, and like, it's everything is like in tune with the editing and the filmmaking. Just like, even you could say Fear and Loathing, like the filmmaking is like supposed to attune you to the style of being fucked up, but like Wake and Fright is actually well thought out in the script stage, and like it's such a good movie.
Eric, you said that, you know, like there are some, even though it is kind of depressing and crazy, there are some entertaining parts in it, and I feel like, doesn't it kind of follow the trajectory of getting blackout drunks? Like,
yes,
like there are
yes.
sections where it is fun and it is crazy and entertaining, and as batshit crazy as they become, and then like you know you go through those periods and then you drink way too much, and then it becomes kind of confusing yep. and crazy, and then the next morning comes and you get the hangover, and it's just depressing and sad. And
this was the point I was always trying to make. Yeah. I'm sorry. This is the point I was always trying to make about Spring Breakers. Like, I'm not saying that it's a one-to-one, like, it's so similar to Wake and Fright, but it's a similar point I was trying to make of, like, that movie follows the Spring Break trajectory, and that's the ups and downs of the narrative that it has. And Wake and Fright, in its way of being a drink, it's a binge movie. It's a booze binge movie. It does follow that, and that's all. That was sort of the point I was always trying to make about mm-hmm. Spring Breakers. What I liked about it in the same way is that, like, the form and the content, everything was sort of, it's this perfect sort of cyclical relationship, you know, and that's why I love the movie so much, is like, those are my favorite kind of movies. Like, it is all these things. Like, we've kind of already got at it, but you have to say like how complex this movie actually is too. Mm-hmm. Like, it's crazy entertaining. We've noted that, but also I love how complex this movie is, because Octay, you described Wake and Fright as like sort of a living nightmare for the lead character. but he's the asshole. You know what I mean? Like, it's Ryan sort of pointed out, like, you know, for him it's a nightmare, but some people love the Yabba, you know? And I love that the movie's balanced. Like, the characters aren't buffoonish, like, freaks. They might seem that way or you in a lesser movie, but
Donald Pleasance's character definitely enjoys his kind of out there animalistic
existence. He's fascinating because he's an alcoholic. He knows he's an alcoholic, and he chooses to live in this place because people don't notice that he's an alcoholic because he just fits in. That's such a fascinating idea. That's why he's such a brilliant character. Like, tell me another character that exists like that. Like, that's an original movie character, and Donald Pleasance does. I'm so glad you brought it up.
Well, a movie that I'm gonna compare it to is Lost Weekend. That's another character. Mm. The Ray Milan character in The Lost Weekend is like
Billy Wilder movie.
Yeah, Billy Wilder movie. Have either of you seen
it?
I need to see it. It's great. It's going to be on one of the episodes soon. Good. For sure. It's definitely on my list. Let's go through another couple of, like, you know, some other movies before we get back into the issue of addiction, but you know. This is the movie that, like, reminded me the most of The Lost Weekend, especially in the way that it perfectly brings you into the mind of an addict, which is not really particularly where you want to be. And this is one of those movies. Waking Fright is definitely like a film that I can imagine myself watching again, maybe because it's not about a writer, so I don't feel that kind of intense personal connection to it. The Lost Weekend is basically a masterpiece that I kind of never want to watch again. it gets that intense and personal about, like, the cycle, the never-ending cycle of alcoholism, and it's an incredibly depressing and incredibly sad movie. And in that, Ray Milan's character, who's kind of like a failed writer who was, like, kind of hot shit when he was young, and then he kind of, like, gave it all up, and now he can't even, you know, he just basically binge drinks till he dies. And he's kind of like that kind of character who's just, like, completely self-aware of where he is and what he is and how hopeless his life is, and kind of just, like, powers through it and unapologetically. And Donald Pleasance's character reminded me of that, and Wake in Fright in a way that, like, goes hand in hand with The Lost Weekend in the way that it captures that cycle perfectly. Like, the ending is Billy Wilder has an ending very similar to Wake in Fright, but it's a lot more subtle. You think, like, everything's like, oh yeah, it's a new chapter, and then you realize that he's basically ending his movie exactly in the same way that he began it, and you're like, oh no, this is just a cycle. So you get the same kind of thing. If
there's a movie from last year, Heaven Knows What, had a very similar, accurate cyclical sort of ending to its, you know, drug addiction story. And it really is, you know, kind of the only true way you can end a story like this. And I think you're right to bring up these other examples, because I think Wake and Fright, though it's a lot lesser known, is should belong in the conversation.
I mean, Last Weekend was a Best Picture winner. It doesn't get mentioned nearly as much, but you know, it's another thing that I want to bring up that I want to hear you guys' thoughts about it. I don't know if you thought about it while you were watching it, about the many layers of this film. It's like this film is kind of like an onion, as Shrek would say. There are many layers. You just, like, peel them off, and the top layer is that this is, you can watch this movie and enjoy it as, like, this, like, unique waking nightmare kind of experience. And then the other layer is this, like, thematic study of the cyclical nature of addiction and alcoholism. And then there's another layer about how basically the colonial forces in Australia are the real savages. So about, like, how much death and destruction and ugliness that the white people have brought to these lands. I mean, there's a reason why none of the people who act like crazy assholes are Aborigines. and they go out there, and you know, you get the text at the end of the movie that says, like, yes, the kangaroo hunting scene was real. It was shot while, you know, these hunters were hunting for kangaroo. But it also says that, you know, we thought it was important to show that how destructive that the kangaroo hunting was. So this is a film that's, like, very aware of how the colonialism in Australia and how the white people basically who go into these lands, maybe, you know, it can be Australia, America, wherever you want to think about, Africa, and just basically bring in the guise of civilization, but actually act like the real savages. Right. And I think that's why, like, it strikes me as like a very deliberate choice that when you mentioned, Eric, and I noticed in the film, when they go off the deep end and they basically start fighting each other and making all these guttural sounds that yeah. make them sound like more animalistic than the kangaroos that they're shooting. The kangaroos just basically just keep to themselves and they don't attack, they don't do anything, and they go out there and they start like. There's this like violent stabbing scene of a kangaroo and there is the one
fighting kangaroo that is credited. There is the one fighting kangaroo.
Yeah, I guess
that scene is amazing, by the way. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Sorry to cut you.
And it's hard to watch, but
it's a great scene. Yeah, it's because it's so real. It's like I'm both in awe that much. Like danger can be felt in a movie, you know, still like it's good to be reminded of that, but also it makes me wince because I'm like, oh, those are actual kangaroos. Like,
so did you guys pick up on that? What do you guys think about the idea?
I love
the commentary about like colonialism and white people's destruction of Australia, basically.
I was just say I did not think of that. That's the fascinating angle. I did not like make that connection, but that's definitely something that's there.
I also think Octa, I love what you're saying, because I think there's a real reason that like I've never read about it, but this actor Gary Bond that plays the lead character to me is like a dead ringer. He looks like Lawrence of Arabia era Peter O'Toole. Mm-hmm. Like at a glance, he's like his doppelganger, and I think there's a real reason that you cast a guy that looks like maybe the most iconic British actor, one of the most, and mm-hmm. he's this British character in this world, and I think it feeds into what you're talking about, Octave, the colonialist aspect of this movie, or the subtext, because he's stuck in the middle of nowhere, and he doesn't want to be there. That's what, at this point, modern-day Brits would feel, you know, but there's this, like, you see this cycle of, or the pattern of, like, what's happened to this land because of that through all the years. And when you have an actual Brit as your lead, he's this, like, Peter O'Toole looking bastard, but he's kind of a piece of shit and hates where he is. He's stuck in this cycle with these people that have been bred in this area, actually. They're a part of this country, or like the Donald Pleasance character, they actively want to be there because their debauchery can exist there. And that is a very deep and cutting comment on that. I'm with you, man. And I think it adds this is a movie of layers. It's another factor of like what I was trying to get at, of like how these guys aren't all bad guys. Like they're kind of just nice local guys that try a little too hard, but they want to be nice to the John Grant character. They're all like, they take care of him. Mm-hmm. It's just, he's the problem, you know. It's like he's not the hero, but he's the protagonist of the movie, and he doesn't act like a hero. It's like he's the jerk. I like that aspect of this movie. The easier route to make a movie like this is make those people the freaks and the douchebags, and he's the guy that we're supposed to cheer for, but he's not yet. And I just love that. It's like, for me, that's another layer that also feeds into what you're ultimately saying, Octave, which I think is really, like, spot on.
Well, it's like that U-turn scenario, like, talk about a bad Oliver Stone movie, where it's like the premise of, like, the straight man going into a town full of crazies and trying to get out of there. And there's a bunch of movies made like that. But yeah, it kind of flips that on its head a little bit. Then you start realizing that a lot of the people who live in this city are somehow comfortable in their own skin. And he's the one who just like kind of wants to get in there.
He thinks he's better than everybody,
He's better than everybody. And I feel like that's part of why, and maybe part of like the homoerotic aspects of it, maybe that he makes a decision to do something at the very end of the movie. That is that's a little bit shocking, but at the same time, it makes sense when you watch it. You're just like, yeah.
Well, I think the realization of what he may or may not have done, it shatters his own personal world. I mean, there's that great descent into madness, another great textbook editing, you know, scene where he's running and he's envisioning like him having you know, intercourse with the other girl, or at least attempting to, and then his girlfriend, and then like his girlfriend with Donald Pleasance, and this just mixture of just sexual confusion that ultimately leads him to do something that is like you said, Octay, is incredibly shocking.
Yeah, it almost goes into like it makes sense what he does because of like how it looks like he kind of envies Donald Pleasance's like effortless way he can just like let go of all inhibition, and he wants to kind of, and I think that's why he has that night with him, and then the decision that he makes afterwards is almost like his last ditch attempt at any sense, like leaving behind that craziness and any sense of normalcy, in a way that's almost like, you know, like the narrator in Fight Club just shooting himself in the head and like getting rid of Tyler Durden, like that dark part of yourself that he's just like desperate to get rid of, and which
there's that whole scene. Yeah. There's that whole scene with Donald Pleasance the first time he crashes at his house, where they wake up and Donald Pleasance is talking about the woman that John Grant like had tried to sleep with, but he gets sick before anything can happen. He, you know, Donald Pleasance talks about all the like sexual escapades he's had with this woman, and like he even says, he's like, we know ourselves, like something to that effect, like we've pushed ourselves to such a degree and tested our limits that we know ourselves better than anybody, I think is the like the essential point, you know, I'm paraphrasing, and that is essentially the test that the lead character goes through, or that he puts him through, but he's like wants to go through. And it's really interesting to think about, like, yeah, this is an alcoholic story, but one where you're like, yeah, I don't know, it's like he's not a sad, pathetic one, at least not from the outset. I don't know, it's a very complex movie.
It is, yeah. It's,
that it is.
It's fucking great. It's definitely one that, I feel like maybe the since Alamo Drafthouse released it, since they also released a lot of like, you know, Lost, So Bad It's Good movies, like Miami Connection, and recently like Dangerous Men and
The Visitor.
People might get the idea that like this is one of those like, you know, early 70s like exploitation movie that got lost, and it's gonna be like this so bad it's good kind of thing, but this is a genuinely great film, and I would put it more in the category of like, I hear exploitation being brought up from time to time about this, but I would like move it so, I don't see it, I would move it so much further into the like the Australian New Age filmmaking of Nicholas Roeg and Peter Weir, and like those types of movies, like those types of great films with great substance and layers and like very like kind of progressive filmmaking. I would put it there. It's you know, it's kind of a I like First Blood for what it is, but it's a bit of a shame that Ted Kotcheff never really you know, made of, I don't think, I mean, as far like The Fun with Dick and Jane and all that stuff, like the films that he made that I've seen, that it's nothing as good as this. So it's interesting. So yeah, I'll just
oh my god, he did Weekend at Bernie's.
Yes.
Holy fuck. That's embarrassing, dude.
that's bad.
That is bad.
So yeah, let me,
North but Dallas he did Wake 40? And Fright. Ooh! Did he do that?
Yeah, he did. Yep. But like you said, Eric, he did do Wake and Fright, and it's a fantastic movie. And Octave pretty much hit it on the head. What I would say, this isn't like it can fit in the exploitation movie, but I think it is so much better than that. And it's a movie that, like I said, when it was re-released, it's preaching to the converted. But I think that if you love unique, you know, unique movies and challenging movies and just downright entertaining movies, it's a great movie and you should seek it out.
Yeah, so do you guys want to hear about my brief meeting with Ted Kotcheff in 2005?
Sure. Oh yeah, this will be a good way to cap this episode off.
Yeah, go I guess it. That's true. I guess we went through all of the things that we were going to go get through. So our acting teacher at the Academy of Art in San Francisco in 2005, like right at the year when I graduated from my MFA program, I wrote a couple of scenes for her acting class, and she really loved those scenes, and she was like, you're a really good writer, so let me take you to LA and get you some general meetings with a couple of people that could maybe help you out. So and a general meeting is basically like a meeting that you take as a writer that's where you're not really talking about a specific project, you're basically just meeting up with producers and directors and shooting the shit about, like, oh, what are you working on? What am I working on? Maybe you'll come up with something that's interesting that they'll be like, oh, you know, why don't you send me that script or something like that? And that happens about, like, 1% of the time. Usually you just, like, sit and, like, talk and, you know, that's it. So I was like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, it'll still be a cool, like, great experience. I'll get some, like, general meetings. And I went to, apparently, the acting teacher, her name was Diane Baker, by the way. And she was a pretty, she was the, she was Marnie's, no, not Marnie's sister, sorry, Sean Connery's sister in Marnie, the Hitchcock film. And she was... another big role that I've... Oh, she was the mayor in Silence of the Lambs. The mother of the girl that got kidnapped.
Right.
So you guys might get, like, a mental image from there. And so anyway, she took me, and her friend was an executive producer on Law & Order Special Victims Unit. So I went to the... it was at the Universal lot, and I went into their, like, little office, and he was just shooting the shit, hanging out with Ted Kotcheff. And I didn't know who he was, and it turns out that he was going to be, like... You know, since he was just kind of hanging around talking about the next episode that he was going to direct. So he was just like, yeah, I'll stick around for the meeting, whatever. You know, we'll talk to this kid. And he was the coolest guy. He was basically like, oh, your name sounds, your last name sounds Bulgarian. Do you have any, like, you know, Bulgarian, like, in your family? And I started talking about, like, you know, yeah, back when Turkey was the Ottoman Empire, you know, my father's side, a lot of people say that we come from, like, Bulgarian roots and stuff like that. So we talked about that, and we talked about, he told us, like, this, he told me this, like, insane story about, like, how he tried to get Frank Langella to do a part in one of the Law & Order episodes. And mm-hmm. Frank Langella kept telling him, like, I've played every single type of character that you can ever think of, and you can never come up with some kind of character that I've never done. And if you come up with that, I'll do your shitty show. And apparently, like, one of the episodes, he came up with this, like, really insane, weird character that was in the episode, and he brought it to Frank Langella, and Frank Langella was like, all right, you got me. So he did the episode, and look it up in Law & Order SVU. He did one of those episodes, and whatever that episode is, I guess that was the character that Frank Langella was like, yeah, I've never done a character like that. Yeah, and then he was just like, yeah, while we're shooting in New York, why don't you come up, if you come up to New York, you can, like, hang out at the set and stuff like that. And then he just left. So that's my Ted Kotcheff story for you. And I had no idea. I only knew, I knew, like, who he was, but I knew him as the director of First Blood. Yeah, I didn't bring up Weekend at Bernie's. I knew he directed that too, but I was just
I think of is that Seinfeld episode where Elaine rents Weekend at Bernie's, yeah, and she's just screaming at her TV the whole time. Anyway, I'm sorry.
So I wish that back then, I'm sure that he would have, like, really appreciated it too, because nobody knew about that fucking movie.
If I had
seen it somehow, but that was 2005, so it wasn't even, like, being... It was just about to be restored back then, I guess. But
that's what's so cool. What Draft House does, right? Like, yeah, that's true. Like this guy that we knew. Like, if you were to look it up, as I just did, and, like, oh, here's the guy that made Weekend at Bernie's, a movie I had seen, and it's stupid. It, come on, it's a joke. But, like, he made a Ram. You know, he made the first Rambo movie, and then, but, like, he also made this great little 70s Australian movie. This, and yeah, that's the coolest thing about, like, what Draft House does is, like, unearthing and other distributors like them, and it's like, it's proof of, like, what an exciting time it is to be a movie fan when there's, like, this news of this streaming site, Filmstruck, that's going to acquire all the Criterion movies and all these, all these other libraries of other great distributors. You know, folks like Drafthouse Films that have been maintaining these movies like Wake and Fright and ensuring that they'll last. And it's not some scuzzy exploitation movie. It has elements of that, but it's also not some, like, pretentious art house movie. It's this great marriage of the two, and that's why people should seek it out. Is that it's, like, it's entertaining, but also, like, you're gonna get a full meal from this movie. It's really something. And yeah, I love that. Like, what a time that we're in, where, like, movies like this are just, like, coming back and looking as good as they did when they were shown in their original release. Like, it's pretty rad.
Yeah, that's gonna be awesome. We should seek out, like, a sponsorship deal with them.
Yeah.
get some free streaming accounts.
Oh my god, that'd be that's sweet. A good idea.
Yeah,
because then we could pick a bunch of their movies. That's actually a good idea, man. Yeah, I'll see what Rod says.
Yeah, let's get fucked up and call them. Yeah. All right. What do you guys think? Should we wrap it up? So thank you for listening to another episode of Over Under Movies. I hope you had a good time, and I hope you will seek out Wake and Fright, and you know, watch the first 10 minutes of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and you know, kind of skip through and watch it in sections. There's some fun stuff in there. And the before we get to the end, I do have some frightening news about next episode. I am already looking into the Witness Protection Program. It's going to be rough. The next episode are going to be my picks. And I am picking... Basically, we are going to be dickheads for the next episode because we're doing Philip K. Dick adaptations.
Nicely.
And I am picking... For underrated, Richard Linklater's rotoscope animation, Philip K. Dick adaptation, A Scanner Darkly, and for the overrated, we're gonna do Blade Runner. So that's
you this son
is,
of a bitch.
This is happening. It's gonna be my pick, and yeah, we're probably gonna record the next episode in some kind of underground bunker somewhere.
They can't find us for protection.
Yeah, you can't find us. Don't even try. But we're gonna piss off a lot of fanboys. I have a feeling. At least I am.
Octane's a replicant, you guys. It's we should just say it right now. Octane's a replicant. So,
and it'll this will be the one version we release of this episode. There will not be a final cut, a director's cut.
That's gonna be it. There's not gonna be like five different fucking versions with tiny little alterations.
But Octane is a replicant. That is this version. He's a replicant.
Yeah, they exist.
Yeah, he is. And so, he's gonna be doling voiceover out throughout the episode.
Yeah, so. like really, really boring monotone voiceover, like as if you really, really don't want to be there, which was the case for Harrison Ford. But that's what you can look forward to next time. So if you want to catch up with those films, go ahead. And we're probably gonna be don't watch the theatrical version. We're probably gonna be talking about either the. I would recommend the final cut. You know, we'll watch the final cut. We might get into like some differences between the final and the director's cut, but that's the one that we're gonna talk about, I would say. What do you guys think? Like that
sure.
would be the
yeah. Let's do the final cut. The
preferred version for me as well. So yeah, if you want, and there's only one version of A Scanner Darkly because Richard Linklater is nowhere near as anal as Ridley Scott is. So that's going to be fun. Look forward to that. So signing off, this is Akte Ege Kozak, film critic for The Playlist, The Oregon Herald, DVD Talk, and BeaSpider.com.
And I'm Eric McClanahan, film critic and podcast editor for The Playlist, and my other podcast is Adjust Your Tracking. I also write for Oregon Arts Watch.
Signing off is Ryan Oliver, contributor here at The Playlist, and I co-host another podcast called Unspooled Reel.
And, of course, you can always find us on The Playlist, about to be theplaylist.net starting Monday. And you can also find us on Twitter at OverUnderMovies and Facebook.com/OverUnderMovies and on our regular iTunes feed a couple days after it gets posted on The Playlist. But for now, have a great day. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye.
Give it to Ryan. Ryan, you should find a wrapping up point, I think.
Okay, let's do it.
What? What about a wrapping up point?
I just wanted to give you the final word because, you know, these are your picks. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's all good. I did my wrap up before Octave's Ted Ketchoff story.
Oh, that's right. I'm retarded. Never mind. Yeah. All right. Wrap it up, Octave. Right.
This might make the blooper reel. We might have
to do something like that. Fair play. Okay.